Good morning, everybody. So I've got everything I need up here. I've got water, I've got chocolate biscuits. So I should be able to make it through the next half hour. I've checked the canal river and it's not going to flood during the service. So hopefully we can relax. If you have your Bible open at Ecclesiastes chapter 2, that would be great. The book of Ecclesiastes is written in order to help you to be wise about life. There's no point living life according to a fantasy about life that isn't really real. So Ecclesiastes helps us to be realistic about how life is and how it should be lived. And the Bible is a fascinating book, isn't it? It's all kinds of different kinds of writing in the Bible. My wife loves Proverbs. Right, she just gets a thought and she goes with it. Whereas I find Proverbs really difficult because one verse doesn't seem to follow the next. Do you know? Ecclesiastes, if you're a sort of reflective, philosophical kind of person, you'll love Ecclesiastes. If you're not, then you might need to work a little bit harder at it. But it's to help us to understand what life is like. So Ecclesiastes chapter 2, you know, when you're having a difficult time and you go to your happy place, what's the dream? What's the happy place that you go to? Does it involve a larger house, perhaps, with all the extensions that you want to put on? Obviously, you'll be having a busy social life. An appreciative spouse, perhaps. Fulfilling sex life. You'll be working hard in order to achieve things. You'll also want to be maximising your kids' chances, won't you? So you'll be going around in the evenings, perhaps in your 4x4, taking them to all those clubs so that they have every opportunity in life. The best opportunities that you can give them. The family holidays, something to think of this time of year, isn't it? Or maybe you're more like Sophie. You're thinking of the culture, being creative. Maybe you're thinking of dedicating yourself to good causes that really make a difference. Have I covered it? When we haven't got those things, it's easy to think, do you know what? If only I had that. If only I had that, I would feel so much more fulfilled. Well, Ecclesiastes was largely written by a guy called the Teacher, and he had it. He had it all. It says here, some sort of royal person, and he had all those things that I've mentioned. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, he's reporting back to us what it's like. How is it to have all these things? Do any of them really give us ultimate fulfillment? Now, when we read Ecclesiastes, it's telling us a truth about life that you need to hear and I need to hear. But it's not the whole truth. So we'll take it that way. We'll see what's the truth here. And then what does the rest of the Bible say? How does it fill out and give us the full picture? So the quest for meaning. So chapter 2, beginning chapter 1 verse 12, he starts a quest to try out different things to see what is it like. Can this thing prove really meaningful? And everything he tries are good things. They're things that other places in the Bible will tell you are excellent things. But the question he's asking all the time is, so it's good, but does it really fulfill me? Does it really give me meaning? And naturally, because he was an academic sort of chap, the first thing he tries, chapter 1 verse 12, is wisdom. wisdom. Chapter 1, verse 12, he researches wisdom. And then in chapter 2, verse 12, he compares what's it like to be wise to being stupid. So he compares wisdom to folly. Study, books, knowledge, letters after your name. We really value education, don't we? And often we think education is the answer to things. Children perhaps tempted to use drugs. What they need is drugs education. Problem with teenage pregnancy. What they need is relationships education. Now, the teacher was a very wise person, was kind of a professor who gathered others to be taught and to reflect. And this is what he says. In that chapter 2, verse 12, down to verse 17, this is his reflection. It's much better to be wise than the opposite. Compares wisdom to folly. Can you think of someone who lives, you think lives really wisely? Really shrewdly. They really seem to have, over the years, developed insight into the way things are. And to talk to them, you feel that you learn a lot. And yet there may be other people that you could look at, and you feel they're not wise. They make the same mistakes time after time, year after year, relationship after relationship, decade after decade. There are obstacles and they always bump into them. They don't see them coming. So it's much better to be wise, says the teacher, than to be foolish. Of course it's better. But does being wise give you ultimate meaning? Well, back in chapter 1, he reflects like this. He says the problem with being wise, I mean, I wouldn't know, but he says it here. He says the more you know, the more you realise you don't know. If you talk to someone really clever, they're often not that dogmatic. They're very careful with their opinions. Because the more you know, the more you realise how complicated things are and how much we don't yet really know. Remember, the tree of knowledge was in the Garden of Eden, and we've been evicted from the Garden of Eden. There's so much knowledge that's just not accessible to us. So it's frustrating to be wise, so he says. But worse than that, says in chapter 1, verse 15, though education is really useful, education is very helpful, frustratingly, education cannot change the human condition. Says what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. For all our education and all our technology that we've developed, are we better than people 100 years ago? Are our relationships better? Are we happier? Is the human condition changed for everything we know? No, it's not. So education's good. But wisdom cannot change the fundamental human condition. And what really frustrates him, he says, is the wise and the foolish, they all end up the same. You know, when you go on a family walk through the countryside and you come to a nice village church, and you think, well, let's have a look around the graveyard. And you look at the names on the gravestones and how long they lived and who was related to whom. Which one of those people were wise and which ones of them were complete idiots? You don't know. One of them may have lived a really wise, shrewd, careful life. One of them may have been a complete bum who wasted his life. But nobody knows, nobody remembers. They're just names on a stone. And he says, though wisdom is better than being folly, here's the frustrating thing, we all end up the same in the end. So enlightenment won't bring you meaning. So try something else. Start of chapter 2. Tries pleasure and projects. Verse 3. It's important to see that he's not saying pleasure is bad. He's not miserable. But he's saying, can chasing pleasure really satisfy me? And you might think, okay, if you're being philosophical, it's hard to find ultimate meaning. Why don't we just enjoy ourselves? He tries laughter. Now, laughter is great medicine. Really does you good to laugh, doesn't it? But laughter only gives you a temporary lift. So many of the best comedians actually struggle with depression. Laughter is not really a solution. It's a useful temporary lift. And then he says, I tried partying. He says, I was still guiding myself with wisdom. I wasn't just living it up. I was trying to understand what's really worth doing with your life. And this is what I found from partying. It gave me spikes of pleasure. It was good while it lasted. But if you party night after night after night, what you'll find is that pleasure fades. You go out and you go out with your friends and perhaps you go clubbing or whatever you do. And then you repeat and then you repeat and then you repeat. But it's not enough. Ultimately, that doesn't fill us up. He says it's not a satisfaction that lasts. So he tries partying and his glass is full. But somehow his heart is still empty. Do you know that feeling? So he tries instead projects. And the key word, if you see from verse 4, says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. For myself. He's still doing this to see if he can find some meaning in creating great projects. So he builds houses and gardens and public parks with lakes and fountains and clever irrigation systems. In order to do this, he has a massive staff of slaves and servants. In fact, because he's a shrewd dude, he amasses a fortune. He also says that he had music when he wanted it. He didn't need an app on his phone to get music. He had male and female choirs there, ready to perform for him whenever he wanted. The best culture his society could provide. And he had women available to him at the click of a finger. He said, I became great. I became famous. My lifestyle was the envy of others around. People looked at me and thought, wow, now he's really made it. And as he steps back from that, what he says was, do you know what? Of all those things, there was something pleasurable about work, about toil. It was good to get up each day and see I'd built something and then taken it a little bit further. That was good. But when I stepped back from this and asked, so overall, what is achieved? Is it lasting and meaningful? He said, no. It wasn't. It was still vanity. It was still meaningless. You getting a bit fed up with him? Do you think this guy's just kind of glass half empty? I don't think so. I think the thing about him is he's just too wise. He's just too smart. He can see everything for what he is, and he's ruthlessly honest, much more honest than we normally are. So then he tries work and achievement, and he reflects on this particularly from verse 18. Now here is a guy who's really, really achieved. If you think, who in my life would I like to emulate? This teacher really had been a great success. But he says, as I reflected on that, do you know what really got to me? I have to hand it all over to the bloke that follows me. Now, what will he be like? I've got no control over that. All these things I've built and made, will he maintain my parks and keep them beautiful? Will he look after the statues? Or will he fill them with kitsch and distasteful things? But I have no control over that, whatever. And here's the frustrating thing. I've done all the hard work. I've built all these things, but the fate of them all rests in the hands of my successor, who may be wise or he may be a complete idiot. I have no control over that. I've been in various jobs where it's been either a new role or it's moved in a different direction when I've had it. And I spend the last week of my job writing extensive handover notes for the person who will take the job after me. I think all the knowledge I've built up is all going to go with me, so I want to get it all down on paper so that it stays with the organisation. And then I'll phone the person who's got the job once they've been doing it for 2 or 3 months and say, so how are you getting on? Say, how are you getting on with so-and-so? And I say, well, who's she? Who's she? I don't know who she is. She's a key contact. You need to be in touch with her. And what you did, how has this developed? Oh, I haven't got to that at all. You see, that's the main thing. And I can see all my work going to seed. I mean, to be fair, in my case, they probably improved it. They probably realised I was barking up the wrong tree and they've taken it in a different direction. But whatever you achieve, you hand over and you have no idea how the next person will develop it or not. Many of us give an awful lot to work. We put a lot of energy and emotion into work. And work promises us, it seems, satisfaction, recognition, and the opportunity to make a contribution. And the teacher reflects, do you know what? It did give me a bit of satisfaction. I did really enjoy working and creating something. But, verse 23, I also reflected that it really wore me out. And you know, at work think of the people in my congregation, and so many of them get frustrated at work. There's always people problems at work, aren't there? And there's always worry about work because there's pressure to achieve. And it says, verse 23, I was doing this great work, but I couldn't sleep at night because I was worrying about how it was going. So work did give me some degree of happiness, but there's a flip side to it as well. And it did give me recognition while it lasted. It's quite nice. I've just turned 50. It's quite nice being 50. Because generally, whatever you're doing, you kind of know what you're doing. And you see these young whippersnappers coming up. And, you know, you understand what they need to do. So there's a bit of recognition. But he says that recognition is soon forgotten. When you're in the old people's home, no one will remember that you were a very competent social worker. Two people in the old people's home with Alzheimer's. One was a very high achiever. And the other wasn't, in human terms. And where are they now? They're both in the same condition. And work promises us the opportunity to make a contribution. And we do make a contribution, but as he's reflecting, it's so fragile, isn't it? The more you build your life on work, the more you will experience the brokenness and meaninglessness of this world, says the teacher. So which of these does your heart get drawn to? Do you think if only I could read more books and be more knowledgeable and achieve, that's what I really want for my kids, that would make me happy? Or do you think of pleasure? Hey, you're due a good time, aren't you? Or is it about work and achievement? The teacher is ruthlessly honest. And Ecclesiastes 2 is actually a very sad and moving passage if you listen to it. So for all he's done, for all he's achieved, look what he says in verse 17. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind. And verse 20, as he reflects on the fragility of his achievements, he said, so I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Here is a very honest, straightforward, decent bloke. And it's also disappointing. It's not the problem of not having made it. A lot of the time we feel rubbish because we don't feel we've made it. And there's other people who have made it. Or so it's said. This is the problem of success. When you haven't made it, you think, oh, if only I made it in this way or in that way or had it, that then I would be happy. But I read something from a reporter in Hollywood, said she was a contemporary of people who were trying to climb the ladder. And they were nice people while they were trying to climb it. But when they made it, they became insufferable. And she said it's because they always thought that if only I made it, then I would be fulfilled. And then they made it and found out they still felt empty. They still hadn't found something ultimately meaningful. But at last, if you read through Ecclesiastes 2, you come to verse 24 and there is a shaft of light. He steps back and says, so here is some wisdom for life. This is how you live wisely. The problem is, when I did these things, I was expecting too much out of them. I was looking for something ultimate from them, and that's why I was left feeling so frustrated. But that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to receive these things gratefully as good gifts from God. He says to eat and to drink, to socialise, to appreciate family and friends and the good people in your life, to work, because we need to work and do something, to work and to appreciate good, honest toil and trying to achieve what we can. If we could just approach it like that, then we would have happiness in some of these things. This is the way God has set it up. For you to be grateful, for you to appreciate these things. But not to expect too much out of them. Because they will disappoint you. That's how I understand verse 26. I understand verse 26 to say the sinner, the problem with the sinner, is he approaches these things we mentioned in this world and looks for ultimate meaning in them, and he can't find it. He's endlessly frustrated. So they turn sour on him. But the wise person is not looking for ultimate meaning in these things. So he's able just to appreciate what he or she has with gratitude. That is the wise way to live. And I'm grateful for that. And if I'd preached through Ecclesiastes 1, then Ecclesiastes 2, you'd be very grateful for this shaft of light too. I wonder if you're feeling disillusioned this morning with the way your life is, could it be that you've been expecting too much out of it? You had unrealistic expectations of work, of family, and that's why you're disappointed. And what you need to do is to recalibrate. You need to step back from that and just think, well, I just want to appreciate the things what God has given me for what they are. I don't think they're going to give me ultimate happiness, but they're good things, and I just want to appreciate them. So to pray every day, Lord, don't let my heart expect everything out of this, but let my heart just be thankful for what you've given me and what's good in my life. That, he says, is a wise way to live. So a shaft of light. But he's still frustrated. Do you see the last line? He's still miserable. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Oh, I thought we was going to get more positive for a little bit. Although these things are good, I think he says it with an air of resignation. Says there is nothing better than to appreciate. It's kind of saying, what can you do? It's the best we can do. It's just to appreciate these things as good while they're there. But ultimately, he still feels it's meaningless. It's not going to give you meaning. Why can't he just be happy with what he's got and appreciate it? Because it's not enough for us. Chapter 3, verse 11, he's going to go on to tell us that God has put eternity in the hearts of human beings. So it's in our hearts to look for something that's lasting and permanent and has ultimate meaning. We're wired to search for meaning. So we're never satisfied just to say, oh, this is a good thing, appreciate it while you can, but it won't give you ultimate meaning. That's never enough, because we're wired to search for meaning. So it's like we're in a room. It's an escape room. We know that meaning is there. It lies outside of the room. And we keep seeing shafts of light coming into the room. And each shaft of light, we run and grab after it. And it's good to be in the light, but we can't get hold of it. It's not from a window or something that gives us an ultimate way out. So we're stuck. There are good things, but we're looking for ultimate meaning, and we're trapped in a situation in the world where we can't find it. That is the human predicament in which Ecclesiastes 2 leaves you. But you remember I said Ecclesiastes tells you the truth, but not the whole truth. These shafts of light that came in those verses at the end, they came when he started to reflect that God governs the world. There's a God outside the world who governs it. So there is, he senses, a meaning out there, but he just can't lay his hands on how to find it. Please turn to Romans 8, page 1000... Oh, no, no. Page 944. Romans 8, page 944. I'm going to read from verse 19. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, so that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. That word futility is the teacher's favourite word. Vanity, meaningless. If you translate it into Greek, that's that word there. Futility. It says the teacher speaks the truth. The world is subjected to a sense of meaninglessness. But did you notice? God has subjected it to a sense of meaningless. It says God has subjected it to futility. So if God has done it, there's a point to it. There's a point to the pointlessness. And the point is so that we realise what it's like when we detach from God, who's the source of goodness and life and meaning, and so that when we feel that sense of frustration and meaningless, we will turn to look for meaning in the Creator. God has put a desire for meaning in our hearts. He's put an appetite within you that the world can't satisfy, so that you will realise that you can't be satisfied in the world, and you won't look for that fulfillment in the world, but fulfillment in the one who made the world. That's why we experience a sense of frustration, of trying to find meaning, but finding it eludes us. Romans 8 says, this world is frustrating, this world is decaying. Every good thing is undermined by death. But you know what? God is setting us free. God is setting us free from that existence where everything, where there's good, but there's no ultimate meaning. God is remaking the world. If you're in Christ, you're part of a new creation, which is meaningful. And as people turn from trying to find meaning in the things of this world, they turn to God through his Son. Then we find the point of real and true and deep meaning. When you feel that frustration, that sense of frustration is ordained by God so that you will direct your hearts to where true meaning is. Have you found that meaning yet? Have you done that? God is making a new creation which is forever and is not undermined by death. And when you're in Christ, you become part of that new creation. There's a brilliant chapter about the resurrection in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, all about what the resurrection body will be like, what it will be like in the new heavens and the new earth. And then it has this really, well, I've read it before and thought, well, that's a bit boring, the ending. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labour is not in vain. Because if you're doing things for the Lord, if you're working for the Lord, if you're living for the Lord, then whatever you do is part of God's new creation. It's not in vain. It's not meaningless. It's part of something that's going to burst into eternity and cannot be taken away, that is ultimately significant and will not be undermined by death. So I take this to mean not just Christian work, but whatever you do that is done as unto the Lord. He's making all things new. And the moment you become a Christian, you start to live in that new life. Whatever you do for him is not in vain. Everything is meaningful. So what do we do when we feel the frustration of living in this world? Ecclesiastes says to us, the wise thing is to be honest. Don't treat yourself and say, well, if only this, and if only it wasn't that, and if only more of this. Listen to what your heart's telling you. God has set it up this way so that you don't find satisfaction, fulfillment apart from him. It can't be done. So that you look for where real meaning lies. And real meaning lies in God's new creation, which is forever. And if you live in it, if you're consciously living in it, you will know that every moment is absolutely meaningful. So I think Ecclesiastes is saying to us, each day pray this. Thank you for your good gifts, Lord. I want to appreciate everything that you've given me. Be grateful. Be grateful because these things come to you from the hand of God who's given you good things. But Lord, help me not to make these ultimate things. And when they really frustrate me, I pray that my heart will turn to you. And I pray that I'll live in that life with you, which is forever. And as we pray that, each day and every moment will be full of significance and meaning before God.
We're going to stand and sing our final hymn. It's an old one, but the words are fantastic. So let's stand and sing, Not What These Hands Have Done. My beloved brothers and sisters, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that the Lord, in the Lord, your labour is not